This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, this week from the September 19th Encircle Films event at the Eugene Art House, John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, he spoke after a screening of the film One Person, One Vote on the Electoral College. So I have that for you, the Q&A. And don't forget, next October 10th, 2024, the Eugene Art House will be showing Bad Faith on the rise of religious nationalism. For more information, go to encirclefilms.org. And tune in to next week's show with Jesse Neville of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. I did an interview with Jesse Neville, Uhuru Solidarity Movement, very important unreported issue. To support their upcoming trial and black reparations, go to handsoffuhuru.org, handsoffuhuru.org. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. All right, there's been an update on the Uhuru 3. In April 2023, the Uhuru 3 were indicted by the U.S. government on bogus charges of being agents of a foreign government. Because of the Uhuru movement's over 50 years' work to advocate for the liberation and unification of Africa and forcibly dispersed African people everywhere. The charges levied on the Uhuru 3 came 9 months after the FBI and local police violently raided 7 homes and properties of the African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru movement in St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Petersburg, Florida on July 29, 2022. These charges carry prison sentences of up to 15 years. And from an official statement by Chairman Amale Yeshitela on behalf of the Uhuru 3, including Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, this is Chairman Amale Yeshitela's statement. On September 12, 2024, a jury in the federal courthouse in Tampa, Florida, repudiated the more serious charge of the U.S. government's frame-up of the Uhuru 3 by finding myself, along with Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, not guilty of being agents of the Russian government. The prosecutors unleashed a barrage of lies and distortions of the law, along with deliberately confusing jury instructions to mislead the jury into returning an inconsistent verdict, convicting us on the lesser charge of conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States, which we intend to appeal and are confident we will win. But more importantly, the jury's not guilty verdict on the Russian agents charge means that the jurors agreed with the legitimacy of our efforts to advocate for the liberation of Africa and African people. So yeah, they were acquitted of being Russian agents, but they are still as a conspiracy charge. So they need support for their upcoming appeal and sentencing hearing. So they're urging people to submit letters to the judge as we approach our sentencing date scheduled for November 25th. After which we intend to file a motion to appeal the conspiracy conviction. Stay tuned to handsoffuhuru.org in the coming days for more details. And tune in to next week's show with Jesse Neville of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. I have an interview with Jesse Neville on the Uhuru 3 and the FBI raid. We're still having a COINTELPRO in the 21st century, apparently. So that's coming up. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. And tune in to next week's show with Jesse Neville of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement.
John Nichols was born and raised in Wisconsin, where he lives and where he's speaking to us from tonight. He earned a master's degree from Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. He's associate editor at the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the National Affairs in Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, has been for 25 years now. He's a fine time to be a regular contributor to The Progressive and then these Times magazine. And John, along with Robert McChesney and Josh Silver, were co-founders of Free Press, an important organization that advocates for a diverse and independent news media and an open internet. Talk about saving net neutrality. These are the folks who have led that fight. John has written, co-written, or edited 15 books on topics ranging from histories of American socialism and the Democratic Party to Analysis of U.S. and Global Media Systems. His latest book, written with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, was a 2023 New York Times bestseller called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. And just a quick personal note here, I'm a political junkie, but I worked as a local government administrator for over 30 years where it was inappropriate to discuss politics at work. That eventually led me to attend a host of political talks, seminars, retreats, cruises when I had time away from work. And during that time, I had the good fortune of running into John Nichols at numerous media reform conferences and nation cruises where I had the chance to discuss politics and the workings of the news media with a journalist whose work I've been reading for the past 25 years and who, along with author and activist heroes of my younger years, people like Gore Vidal, Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, Michael Parenti, has helped to shape my understanding of politics and the news media in these United States. My favorite tribute to John's body of work came from an old friend of his, the inimitable Gore Vidal, who said, "Of all the giant slayers now afoot in the great American desert, John Nichols' sword is the sharpest." We're lucky to have him with us tonight to give us a briefing on the upcoming election, just 47 days from now. And he'll also answer your questions. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome John Nichols to Eugene.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I appreciate it. I can't really see you very well. I hope that you can hear me. And tell me, Phil, tell me how many folks you have there.
I think we sold out, so we've got at least 80 here.
That's a fantastic group. I'm very honored to speak to you. It's been a busy week, a lot of talks and a lot of things going on. We have in Madison, where I live, an Idea Fest, something called Idea Fest. And last night we had Doris Kearns Goodwin. Monday night we had Speaker Nancy Pelosi, former Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I think tomorrow night we've got Liz Cheney, and also Kamala Harris is in town. And then on Saturday night we have Judy Collins and Heather Cox Richardson. So it must be an election season to have all this activity going on. And I'm thrilled that you watched this film tonight, because focusing on the Electoral College is a big deal. Now, Phil tells me that he's given enough lectures and talked enough about the Electoral College that I don't need to go into it very much. But I will tell you, it's a travesty, and it does define our contemporary politics, along with many other aspects of our Constitution, which was written in 1787, has not been adequately updated, and saddles us with a political system in which the losers of elections often get to govern. Donald Trump obviously lost the 2016 election by 3 million votes, still became president of the United States. George W. Bush lost the 2000 election by 500,000 votes, still became president of the United States. And these elections in which the loser ends up governing have profound consequences for this country. It's a very, very serious issue, and one that I'm glad you're exploring. But Phil asked me to come on tonight and talk a little bit about the presidential race and in politics in a more general sense, because I think one of the things that's important to remember is we don't ever have just a presidential race. Our media is presidentially obsessive, and as a result, it struggles to cover much of anything else. But the reality is that presidential races are always coupled with races for control of Congress. All of the House of Representatives is up for grabs, a third of the United States Senate is up for grabs, and in both the case of the House and the Senate this year, either party could get control of those chambers. And so in order to govern effectively, one party has to have control of all three chambers. The presidency, well, all three aspects of this, not chambers. That's the presidency, the House, and the Senate. That happens now and again. Donald Trump had it in 2017 for a time, and what he did with it was pass massive tax cuts for the very, very wealthy to deregulate a lot of the oversight of multinational corporations and to massively increase the Pentagon budget in the United States to a level that is by any reasonable measure globally unsustainable. There are a few other things he did along the way that have been criticized as well. But the end result is that when you have governing control, i.e. that you have, you know, the House, Senate, and the presidency, you can do a lot. You can have a transformational impact on the country. Now, Joe Biden never had governing control. The fact is that Democrats did, after the 2000 election, technically control the Senate. They clearly did control the House, and they had the presidency. But because of a pair of wavering Democrats, and that was obviously Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, they were never really able to get the traction that you would look for in a governing circumstance. And we often hear people now say, well, Biden got all these amazing things accomplished. And it is true. They passed an infrastructure bill. They passed a relief bill. They did a number of other things. But it's comic to suggest that Biden was governing at a level that would be, say, equivalent to LBJ in 1965, 1966, or FDR in much of the 1930s and 1940s, or even Harry Truman after the 1948 election. That just isn't the case because we had, if not fully divided government, at least semi-divided and often dysfunctional governments. So the 2024 campaign, a contest between Donald Trump, the former president, Kamala Harris, the replacement for Joe Biden, who stood down, is not just about that presidential race. It's also about this race for control of the Senate, which is very bitterly and very intensely divided, very intensely fought. And also the race for control of the House, which is a little bit more, there's a little more clarity there, and at least a reasonable suggestion that Democrats could take control of the House. Senate, very much up for grabs. There's a reasonable chance Republicans could get control there. Presidency, at this point, Kamala Harris is ahead. She leads in most, not all, national polls. She also has at least a little bit of an advantage from a polling standpoint in a number of battleground states. And so if the election was held today, I think you could reasonably say there's a decent chance that Harris could become president. There's a reasonable likelihood that the House of Representatives would become Democratic. But I think at the same time, there's a very decent chance that the Senate would be Republican. And so we have the danger in 2024 of a election result that could land us in exactly the same place that we've been in before, right? With one party holding the White House, but not really able to govern in an effective way. And that's what the next month is going to be about. The next month in this country is going to be an intense competition to determine whether one party can get a real upper hand politically. And in this circumstance, at least as of today, the likelihood is that party would be the Democratic Party. They have the advantages, at least some of the polling advantages and some other circumstances that are in their favor. But I would caution intensely against assuming that will necessarily hold. This has been the most erratic, most chaotic year in American politics since 1968. And in 1968, of course, a Democratic president stood down in the midst of controversy about foreign policy. In that case, it was Vietnam. In this case, the president stood down primarily because of his age, but also in the midst of great concern about a very dysfunctional and damaging U.S. policy in the Middle East, in which the United States has supported the Israeli government in its efforts to basically destroy Gaza. You have some parallels there. The difference is that the country has changed. We are not the country we were in 1968. And while we are incredibly unstable at this point as a country, it's a different sort of instability. The instability in 1968 was rooted in a transformation moment. We were coming from a history in this country of deep segregation, which Jim Crow segregation in the South, which denied citizenship to millions of Americans, black Americans, and also all sorts of other discrimination that was either legally sanctioned or at least accepted toward women, toward people of color in a number of groups, toward Native Americans, toward Latinx people. And we, if you recall, at that point, we didn't even have voting rights for 18 to 21-year-olds, people who were being sent off to fight in the Vietnam War. So that transition that was taking place there caused a lot of churn politically and a lot of pushback on the part of conservative forces. Today, it's different. Today, we've had a lot of progress in the last 50 years, and we have a much more desperate effort by conservative forces to undo that progress. Hence the slogan, Make America Great Again. The question, what is again? How far back do you want to go? And obviously that's a subject of great debate at this point. You also have a Democratic Party that is radically different than it was in 1968, our last deeply unstable election year. And in this case, the Democratic Party has, as its nominee, a black woman who is the child of Jamaican and Indian immigrants. I mean, if you want to see the physical embodiment of the transformation of our politics, you're going to see it in Kamala Harris. Now, you may like her, you may dislike her, you may agree with her or disagree with her, but you can't deny the fact that her nomination for the presidency is a measure of tremendous change in our politics. This is a country where we have never had a woman as president. We've had one black person as president, and that was Barack Obama, serving two terms. But otherwise, our presidents have been white men. Primarily, not entirely, but primarily white men from a Protestant background of a certain economic class. And so we've had a very, very narrow politics for a long time. There's evidence of an opening in our politics, not just at the presidential level, but at the congressional level as well. If you look at the mix of candidates, this is a big deal. This is a country that is in the midst of a transformation, and it is just a question of how quickly it happens and how much pushback there is against it. When countries go through circumstances like this, it tends to get very, very ugly quite often. It's sometimes a very positive, easy arc of human progress, but more often not. And I think it's fair to say that this year we are not seeing a positive progression. You can obviously find aspects of that which might be positive in Harris's campaign, the very joyous convention, not entirely perfect, by the way, but one that was very upbeat in many aspects of Harris's campaign. On the other hand, you have in Donald Trump, at this point, a former president desperate to get his position back and willing to literally lie and claim that immigrants in Springfield, Ohio are eating cats and dogs and pets. So it's a messy, messy campaign. And at this point, neither candidate has broken out to such an extent that you can say with any kind of certainty that we're going in a direction that will take us to a particular result. As I've said, there's evidence that Harris is ahead, but certainly not so far ahead that that would guarantee a result. And there is also history which tells us that there have been times in the past where Democrats have been ahead in September only to end up behind in November. So it's going to be an intense next month. And the real challenge, what you want to watch for in this period, is whether one of the candidates actually, and this is in the presidential race, acknowledging that there are all the other important congressional races as well. But the question is whether one of the candidates actually figures out how to speak to the American people in a next stage way, i.e. because that's really what politics is about. It is always a case of whether one candidate figures out to deliver the message of the new era, of the next moment. And at this point, we haven't seen that yet. But there is the possibility that we will. One of the things that I am very sorry about is that we aren't necessarily going to have more debates. We should have a lot more debates. And also, another thing that I find troubling is that we tend to have rallies now, but not great speeches. And so these candidates have been, kind of putting the brakes on and saying, no, I need to take a couple days and then deliver an address to the nation on a deep fundamental issue where I focus on one thing, don't kind of run through the laundry list of what I want to do or what I might propose to do, but actually focus on one issue and go deep on it. I wrote recently that I think Kamala Harris should do that on the issue of immigration. She should come to the defense of Haitian immigrants in Springfield, and she should call out what's happening, but not merely for the purpose of talking about Springfield, for the purpose of using this opening to talk more broadly about the whole of the immigration issue, which has been so warped and so neglected, and so demagogued by, obviously, former President Trump. But I don't think immigration is the only issue where these candidates, both of them, frankly, should be giving deeper, more focused addresses to kind of reframe the debate, reframe the issues. Certainly climate crisis is something that should be discussed. Our lingering economic injustice, which is simply a reality, it's what Bernie Sanders and I wrote about, our lingering racial justice, which is so writ large across our politics and our society. And then also the last thing I'll say is that these candidates should be addressing the biggest change that's going on right now, that's taking place, and that is the AI revolution. The AI revolution, artificial intelligence, and all the machine learning and machine advances that are associated with it, is going to be dramatically more transformational than the digital revolution. The digital revolution changed a lot. It changed so many of the ways we communicate. Even the communication we're doing right now is rooted in the digital revolution. And it has also wiped out newspapers by and large. So it's totally transformed our media systems, et cetera. It's had a huge impact on our politics, not just on how candidates campaign, but also how they communicate and how they fundraise. So the digital revolution is a big deal. The AI revolution, just put it on steroids. 20 times, 100 times as much change. Fundamental change to our economy, fundamental change to our employment, fundamental change to how we live, fundamental change to how we communicate, fundamental change to how we deal with disease. I mean, everything coming at us. And amazingly enough, there was no question on AI, no serious question on AI in the one debate that Kamala Harris and Donald Trump had. There was no question, no serious question on AI in the debate that Donald Trump and Joe Biden had. And there has been no deep, smart, serious address of this issue by either of the candidates, either the major candidates at this point in the presidential race, nor do you hear much serious discussion of it among congressional candidates. Even some of our more well-educated and well-thought members of the Senate, they just don't talk about it. And so we literally have one of the most fundamental changes in the history of the world taking place. A change that, by the way, when applied to military technology, could destroy the world. A change that also could, on the other side, cure many of the diseases that we've struggled with throughout human history. So there's so much going on there, and it's not being discussed. And the fundamental thing that should be discussed, of course, is the fact that we don't have control over this radical change that's taking place. By and large, it's controlled by corporations, as is so much else in our society. And it is a very stilted and dysfunctional politics that doesn't recognize the major issues and the major changes that are taking place and open up a discussion about who should be in control of those changes. And ultimately, the answer is the people should be in control. We should have democratic governance of our technological progress, democratic governance of our societal shifts, because that's not something that you should trust to profit-seeking corporations. So that's a little bit of a frame for the 2024 race, a little bit of a beginning of a discussion, and I've said to Phil that we can take some time for some questions, which will undoubtedly get us to deeper and smarter places in this dialogue. So I will say to Phil and to others who are organizing things, I'm glad to take your questions.
Thank you, John. We'll get some hands up and get a microphone to them so you can hear them.
Here's our first.
Yes, that would be helpful.
Just wondering if you can fill us in on what your thoughts are about the Electoral College and the election in general that's about to confront us.
Bill, if you could repeat that question. I think I got it basically, but I want to make sure I have it well.
Yeah, she's looking for your views on the Electoral College and the impact that it's likely to have on this election. Is that pretty close? Yes.
Well, the Electoral College is a disaster. It shouldn't exist. It should never have existed. It was created for all the wrong reasons by leaders, a handful of white men, white property-holding men, at the founding of the American experiment, who accepted the notion that black people, for instance, would be treated as three-fifths of human beings. It was incredibly backward in their approach, incredibly destructive in what they accepted. It isn't that the Constitution itself is overall a bad document. There are many things about it that are good. The system of checks and balances has much to recommend it. The notion that presidents can't launch wars, but they should in fact be approved by Congress before they're launched. There are many things in the Constitution you can find that are appealing, and there are many of the amendments that have made it better. But at the heart of it is an electoral system that's a disaster. The Senate can be controlled by a handful of small states, which are home to a minority of the population. The House of Representatives can be, and often is, gerrymandered. And the presidency is literally bartered off on the basis of an electoral college, where you can have a circumstance where 7, 8, 10 million more people vote for one candidate, and yet the loser gets to take power. And that there's nothing about that. You can't come up with an argument that that's a good idea. No child that you presented that notion to would say that was fair or reasonable, and yet we're stuck with it. We're stuck with it because it is very, very, very hard to amend the Constitution. So we looked at the national popular vote, but the fact is, even now with the national popular vote compact, which would create a circumstance where the winner of the Electoral College would likely become, or winner of the popular vote, I apologize, would likely become president. But getting that passed through legislatures across the country is incredibly difficult because, frankly, we've started to see resistance to it from particularly Republican legislatures around the country. And so we're stuck with the Electoral College, at least at this point. And we should be looking always for ways to eliminate it, and that's both constitutional amendments, but also strategies like national popular vote and whatever else people come up with. Because we're stuck with it, though, we'll look at the circumstance that we're in right now. What that means is that the presidential campaign is squeezed down to a handful of battleground states, usually 6, 7. That's about where we're at right now. What's fascinating is that Harris has done well enough since getting the nomination that there is some talk of expanding the map. Now, it's fair to say that she did expand the map after taking over from Joe Biden. The states of Georgia and North Carolina are very much in play politically at this point. There is talk that Florida could come into play. Remarkably, there was a poll over the weekend from Iowa that showed it was a 4-point difference there. So there is a chance that you could have a few more states brought into play. But the reality is that most states will not be visited by the candidates. Most states will not see TV ads for the candidates. Most states will not, you know, see the reality of the campaign, or at least the deeper reality of the campaign, because it's so narrowly focused on a handful of states. That's terrible, because the states themselves help to present issues. And when you don't go to the whole of the country, you miss out on huge numbers of issues and huge numbers of concerns around the country. So Electoral College, terrible thing. What is likely to happen at this point, I mean, this is where it gets complicated because most of the battleground states are very closely divided. Even now with polls showing some evidence of Harris being ahead in a number of states, in my state of Wisconsin as an example, that is not locked in by any means, so it's still a very competitive race. I expect we'll still end up in a situation where some of the battleground states might be decided very, very closely. You could have kind of testing of results. But if I was to predict at this point, I think the likelihood is this. I think it is likely that Kamala Harris wins Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. I think there is an increasing likelihood that she wins North Carolina. And probably keeps Nevada, although that's a little tougher one. Arizona and Georgia are still very much up for grabs. And again, while we're talking about opening up other states of map, expanding to other places, let's keep that off the table for at this point. If Harris wins Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and if she also takes North Carolina as an example, she will be president of the United States. That will decide the race. And the challenge with that, of course, is it would be a narrow win.
John, we've got more hands up back here. Is that okay?
I'm sorry, I'm losing you here.
We've got more hands up, people eager to engage with you.
Sure, let me just finish off the thought, and then we'll take the next point. And I'll try to give much shorter answers. But what I will say quickly is that it's a narrow win, and frankly, at this point in our American politics, narrow wins tend to translate to difficult governance. So there's still a lot of the history of this campaign to be written, and we'll see where it turns out as we get to November.
We have a second question there.
I want to thank you for spending the time and sharing your wisdom and experience. I have a question about...
Speak into the microphone, please.
What you said about artificial intelligence,
yep,
and how the people need to be in control of that. Do you think that we were ever in control of the digital revolution? And considering that we cannot apparently control the electoral college, which is, I agree with you, very bad, why is it that a country like the United States, who proclaims to be the leader, the shining light of democracy, why is it that we haven't ever changed the Constitution? And I'm comparing, for example, with a country like Norway. I don't have the exact figure, but I think that since they founded their constitution, they've changed it 80 or 90 times.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
so why this reverence for the constitution as though this is like a religious sacred document that's impossible to change?
Very good question. Very good. Two questions. You succeeded in inserting two very separate questions there. So let's take them in that way. Number one, the issue of artificial intelligence. No, we had virtually no control over the digital revolution, and we see the results of it, right? That we have media platforms that have been created that have created some of the most wealthy corporations in the history of the world. Corporations literally with bankrolls that are bigger than the budgets of most governments around the world, generally located in Silicon Valley. And these corporations do not respond to our needs. They do not respect where we're coming from. And amazingly enough, a very, very conservative economist, Milton Friedman, said that if you have a public good, something that society depends on, and now, of course, we have to accept that society does depend on Google, does depend, you know, to a very large extent on Facebook and other platforms. If you have an entity that society depends on, you can't have it monopolized by one group of very, very wealthy people, by one group of very, very powerful people, or perhaps even by one powerful individual, as you have in the case of Twitter with Elon Musk, and frankly, many of these other companies, Facebook with Zuckerberg. And so you end up with a situation where the digital revolution created monopolies over which the people of the United States have little or no control. These monopolies have a definitional role in our politics. It doesn't mean that they ultimately define every aspect of it, but they're certainly immensely influential. And so we ended up in a mess of a situation. And frankly, there's an awful lot of people who tell you that our children spend a little bit too much time on their phone. And so, you know, we have not just all of the political consequences, but human consequences that I think are very challenging for society. Now we're coming to something that's dramatically bigger than that, the AI revolution. And we ought to learn from the digital revolution that people need to have a lot more power, a lot more say in where things go. So the second question that you ask about, you know, why hasn't the Constitution been amended? This is a really big deal. Yes, our Constitution should be amended far more. We've amended it a few dozen times, but generally it's to clean up aspects of it that were so egregious that you couldn't let them remain. And or at least you had to alter them and improve them to some extent. We've also a couple times done an amendment to clean up a mess created by another amendment, as happened with Prohibition. And so we have not systematically looked at our Constitution to try and make this country more small-d democratic. That's something that happened in much of Europe, and frankly, much of the world. in the aftermath of World War II. Europe had been absolutely devastated by the war, and so there was a lot of sort of new thinking about how to organize a society, and you saw a lot of constitutional framing that was A, progressive, and B, aimed toward making democracy functional. You also at the same time saw a major breaking down of colonialism, European colonialism, and so countries in Africa, Asia, other places around the world began to write their constitutions as well. So most countries have newer constitutions that are often, not always, but often significantly more small-d democratic than the U.S. Constitution. I know in America people don't like the idea of a constitutional convention because they think it will be controlled and abused by one side of the political process, and I understand that, but the fact of the matter is we desperately need to find ways to amend our constitution in all sorts of areas, and whether it's a constitutional convention or frankly just a moment when we pass a lot of amendments, it's time to do that. We need to have an amendment that addresses the absolute inequality related to the U.S. Senate. We need to have an amendment that gets rid of the Electoral College. And frankly, we should consider amendments like to amend the Constitution to change it, as many other countries have, to create basic human rights, a right to education, a right to health care, a right to housing. These are not radical ideas. These are mainstream good ideas that ought to be a part of our governance and ought to be guarantees for human beings.
Hello, John. Randy Prince here.
That's terrific. That sounded really good.
Okay. How are you? When you use that phrase, transformational effect, talking about the digital and the AI revolution, and then you talk about journalism, well, that's what I'd like to ask about with this election, because you're an editor of a town that's got a newspaper. Our town has essentially lost that. No editorial page, no letters to the editor, no local reporting, and so many other towns, so many parts of the country, news deserts. I'm wondering how much that affects this presidential election and also civic participation in general. On one hand, journalism is now more centralized and we have more of it. I spend just as much time reading the New York Times as I ever did reading papers. It was a local paper before. On the other hand, we have so much journalism, you don't really have to be a journalist and abide by any standards. So how much is what we're seeing in this election possibly due to that radical change in the landscape of journalism? And is anybody looking in the political sphere for how we communicate and how we retain civic participation in this new landscape?
So that is a terrific question, as frankly the other questions were as well. Look, the fact of the matter is that journalism has been obliterated in the United States. The digital revolution did it untold damage. And so we have lost thousands of daily and weekly newspapers across the country, those that really the fabric of local journalism. Even where newspapers remain, they have thin shreds of their former selves with dramatically downsized staffs, and they frankly just don't do the job. Radio has become centralized in its ownership and defined more by streaming, often out of LA or New York, rather than a local studio. And television is essentially weather, you know, like seven, 8 minutes of weather along with 6, 7 minutes of sports, and then some crime coverage. It's a mess, and you're not getting much from it. So we see the traditional platforms for journalism in dire straits, giving us not even a minimal attempt at the level of information that we need. And then we also see new media failing to fill the void. Bob McChesney and I, a number of years ago, did a study where we looked at the number of jobs that were lost in traditional media as opposed to the number of jobs that were created in new media. And it was about a 10-to-1 ratio. You lost 10 jobs in traditional media for the one job you got in new media, in actual, you know, serious journalism. So journalism is in crisis. There's simply no question of that. And it's in its greatest crisis at the local level. Why does that matter? And how does it affect the presidential race and frankly congressional races and Senate races around the country? Very simple. When you had a lot of local journalism, the national debate got filtered and reframed at the local level, right? Issues that were a particular concern to a rural area were amplified. And you look at where the candidates stood on that, the candidates frankly had to address those issues. So in Iowa, the Des Moines Register always brought a tremendous amount of farm coverage into the process. In Detroit, the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press always brought a tremendous number of manufacturing, particularly auto manufacturing coverage into the process. And similarly around the country, some places, you know, you were near a military base. That was, it, for lack of a better term, the big industry in a particular area. And so media there covered sometimes military contracting, military weapons production in much more serious ways. We just don't have that anymore. What we've got is a centralized, nationalized media coverage that is dramatically dumbed down. It doesn't have the diversity that we used to have. Yes, we've got the New York Times and the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, ABC, NBC, CBS. They're all out there. And there are journalists who work for these institutions that do a very good job, who really, really do try. But they're operating on the national level. They're not operating on the local level where you can actually have a conversation and where journalism feeds into that conversation and invites people to come back via letters to the editor, op-eds, just the general discourse of the moment, frankly, the coverage of politics and events in communities across the country. This kind of, we talk about dumbing things down, this is dumbing things up. We have dumbed things up to the national level to such an extent that we don't have the little local discourse anymore. The damage to our body politic is almost indescribable. Much of the division that we have in politics today, where we just literally struggle to talk to one another, right, and people really are furious with one another, is rooted in this nationalization of the debate. The fact is that instead of kind of understanding where other people are coming from and frankly having a debate in the context of local issues, local concerns, with other people who often share those concerns, we end up in a situation where so much of the discourse is run out of Washington, out of New York, and it's really framed by the campaigns, right? And media covers what the campaigns are doing in these broad national sweeps without ever getting, you know, really local and really engaged where people live. It's a terrible, terrible direction that we've gone in. And you ask other people thinking of ways to deal with it and maybe change it. Yes, there's a lot of folks working on it. Bob McChesney and I co-founded the group Free Press with the purpose of trying to address many of these issues. If you go to the website, freepress.org, you can read about a lot of the efforts to kind of open things up, to renew journalism. There actually are efforts to renew journalism at the local level. A great project going on in New Jersey right now. There's a measure of hope out there. There are possibilities, but at this point, what we desperately need is political leaders who recognize that this is an issue. Media isn't just something that happens to us. It's a part of the palette of issues that we should be addressing. We should recognize we have a crisis in journalism, and there need to be responses. There needs to be responses to it. And remember, in most countries around the world, they fund public broadcasting, community radio, community television, as well as public radio, public TV, at levels that are astronomically higher than the U.S., sometimes an 80-to-1 ratio. Somebody brought up Norway. The amount of public funding for media there is so dramatically greater than the U.S. that you struggle to calculate it. And that doesn't undermine the discourse. It doesn't create bias. It doesn't create a circumstance where, you know, you have an authoritarian government, you know, communicating, you know, what people should think or something like that. Quite the opposite. The Economist magazine's Democracy Index finds that countries that pour immense amounts of money into public broadcasting and public media tend to be far more democratic, small d democratic, than countries like the U.S. that do not.
I was just wondering about any information or any efforts that you might be aware of to ensure the accuracy of the vote and the peaceful transition of power. Thank you.
That is a terrific question. We have, unfortunately, one candidate who has a record of questioning the accuracy of votes and even seeking to undermine the peaceful transition of power. And so that's a real issue. That's something we should be thinking about. There are groups and organizations that have been working a lot on that. And there are national groups of lawyers and others who focused in on being at the ready to make sure that there is a fair count, that it is overseen in a responsible way. Some of this exists within the government. I mean, you have
cybersecurity task force, isn't that looking to make sure that there's not any kind of hacking of the vote or something like that? But by and large, this exists coming more from the private sector. And you have, you know, groups like the ACLU and Mark Elias's group and others that are really looking very closely at this election process and trying to make sure that it doesn't get warped and undermined. And there will be a lot of folks out there trying to make sure that the process works. Ultimately, however, what makes our political process functional is the acceptance of results by both parties. And the challenge will be if one party, and in this case, the likelihood, not the certainty, but the likelihood, is that if a challenge comes, it will come from the Republican Party. Then what really is up for grabs is the question of whether there are responsible Republicans who say, look, this doesn't make sense. This is going too far. This is wrong. And it is important to understand that in 2020, when Donald Trump tried to overturn the results of an election he lost, much of the pushback came from Republicans in Georgia, in Arizona, and a number of other states. And so it is very important that coming toward Election Day and in its aftermath, an effort be made to have bipartisan, multipartisan commitment to making sure that the results are respected and that they're ascertained, that you get it right. If you have to do recounts, you do recounts. But once you've got the results in place, then also to make sure that there is that peaceful transition of power. And there's a lot of moving parts there, including the fact that, of course, January 6th, the day in which you do that transition of power, or at least the critical vote, the acceptance of the Electoral College votes, comes several days after control of the House and Senate could shift. And so one of the things I tell people is if you want a peaceful transition of power and you want things to function, think hard about who you vote for Congress and U.S. Senate. Because the people that you vote for in November will be seated by January 6th in deciding whether to accept election results or reject them. So it operates on many, many levels. But at the end of the day, the critical test is going to be who is there in Washington, you know, in January to make sure that that the result is respected and that it's respected no matter who wins, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, that at the end of the day, there is a recognition that it is healthier for America to have a peaceful transition and to respect the electoral processes than anything else. Why? Because if you respect peaceful transfer power, if you respect election results, you create a situation where if things don't work out, you can have another election and you can vote people out of office. But if you develop a systemic disregard for election results, efforts to overturn them, and ultimately a disregard for the peaceful transition of power, you end up in a situation much like Hungary, where they have elections, but they don't really have a transfer of power.
I think we're about out of time, John, but just one quick thought on a big part of the mess that we're in now will fall into the courts, where we've got a big problem with the Supreme Court that's bigger than anything in my memory with that institution. How best to address that?
Sure. The Supreme Court's a disaster. I mean, and you know, I hate to be saying so many of the questions have been asked tonight. My response is to say this thing is a disaster, or that thing is a disaster. But it is the fact that, you know, if you've got a car that's 230, 40 years old, and you haven't done much maintenance on it, it isn't going to run very well. And we haven't done a lot of maintenance on our process to make sure that it runs at its best, in its best ways, fairest, most honest, most small-d democratic. And so a lot of things are breaking down, a lot of things aren't working well at this point. And so, yeah, we do have, a real challenge with the courts, and that's partially a result of the fact that folks who wanted to control the courts spent decades making sure that they got control of the courts. They've done very, very well. Donald Trump was very beneficial to right-wing efforts to get control of the courts, especially the Supreme Court. Now we have a Supreme Court that is at once corrupt and biased, right? That doesn't rule based on the facts or based on the law. This is a judicial activist majority that seeks to move things in a right-wing direction. They legislate from the bench. There is little question of that, both on social policy and also economic policy. and a host of other things, including presidential power. They wildly, irresponsibly gave Donald Trump or any president essentially kingly powers. So what do you do with a court that is that out of control, that is that irresponsible, that is that in contravention of our basic concepts for ethical judiciary? You have to figure out how to get different people on that court, and the way to do it is to expand the court. That's what Joe Biden has rather tepidly proposed. Kamala Harris has actually supported it, and that is a plan for reforming the courts that allows the president to make more appointments, and also puts some sort of term limit on judges. So I think they serve under the Biden plan, I think it's 18 years, and then they stand down. That effectively creates a circumstance where you can have rotation on the court, also expansion of the court, and along with that, an ethical overlay on the court. That's what we're going to need to do, at least in the short term. And remember, that is something you can do without amending the Constitution. That is something that can be done at the Senate level. So the question of how do you make the courts better, the first question is, who's going to control the Senate after November, or at least after the start of January? If you have control of the Senate by a political party that is committed to expansion of the court, to ethical reform on the court, and you combine that with the president, who is also committed, so committed, you can end up in a situation where we could address a lot of our problems with the courts very quickly, in the spring of next year. On the other hand, if you have a president who is not committed to reform, if you have a Senate that is committed to continue to put biased and often corrupt judges on the highest court of the land, if that continues, if that's the circumstance you end up with, then the court we have today will look like good news, right? It will look like something very positive compared to what we're going to end up with. So we should be very worried about the courts. And frankly, when we vote, among the many issues that influence our votes, and we should always vote, with an eye toward economic and social and racial justice, toward saving the planet, toward diplomacy rather than wars. There's a whole bunch of things that we should be concerned about. But one of the things that we should be concerned about, deeply concerned about, is making sure that we address the clear crisis that has overtaken our courts and made them far less responsive, far less functional, except if you happen to be a multinational corporation or a billionaire who wants the judicial system on your side. Then the courts are very functional. The problem is their function is not to advance the interests of the great mass of Americans.
Thank you so much for spending the time with us. We greatly appreciate it.
What an honor to join you. Thanks to my friend Phil for inviting me. And also, the questions tonight have been just brilliant and spot on. And so the reality is, you know what you need to do. You're obviously smart enough and engaged enough. Go out and do it. Go out and fix this country, because frankly, it needs a lot of repair. And I'm very honored to have been with you. And the quality of your questions gives me great hope for the remainder of this presidential and congressional election.
And tune in to next week's show with Jesse Neville of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. I have an interview with Jesse Neville on the Uhuru 3 and the FBI raid. We're still having a COINTELPRO in the 21st century, apparently. So that's coming up. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. And tune in to next week's show with Jesse Neville of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement.